This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During this final week of the year, we're featuring a few of the many interviews from 2021 that we enjoyed. A TV series that I really enjoyed this year is Schmigadoon, a smart, funny, and loving satire of musicals from the 40s and 50s. It's streaming on Apple TV+. We'll hear two interviews related to the series. Later, we'll hear from Cinco Paul, who co-created the series and wrote all the songs. We'll start with Cecily Strong. She's been a cast member of Saturday Night Live since 2012. In her second season, she co-anchored Weekend Update with Seth Meyers and then Colin Jost. But she left the desk, preferring to do sketch comedy, which she's great at. Her characters have included Fox News host Judge Jeanine Pirro, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, Melania Trump, and the girl you wish you hadn't started a conversation with at a party. This past summer, Strong published a memoir called This Will All Be Over Soon. And now she's appearing in New York in a limited-run production of Jane Wagner's The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe. This one-woman show was a Broadway hit in 1985 and starred Lily Tomlin as 12 characters, something Cecily Strong seems very well suited for. Let's start with Schmigadoon, which is filled with references to classic musicals like Oklahoma, Carousel, The Music Man, The Sound of Music, and of course, Brigadoon. Cecily Strong and Keegan-Michael Key star as a couple trying to reinvigorate their relationship by going on a hike designed for couples who need to reconnect. They get lost in the woods, cross over a bridge, and suddenly find themselves on what looks like a backlot movie set of a small town in the early 20th century, a town called Schmigadoon. The women are wearing long, colorful prairie dresses with big petticoats. The men are dressed like they're in old-fashioned barbershop quartets. The townspeople are singing and dancing as if they're in an old musical. Cecily Strong's character loves musicals and is initially charmed. Keegan-Michael Key's character hates musicals and is desperate to leave. But they both soon realize they're trapped in Schmigadoon, where life is a musical. A leprechaun has explained to the couple, in song, that they can't leave Schmigadoon until they find true love, which means the depth of their love is about to be tested. In this scene, the couple keeps trying to escape Schmigadoon by crossing back over the bridge while bickering about their relationship.
I don't understand. Why couldn't we cross?
I mean...
What?
Look, this whole thing is insane. I'm still trying to wrap my head around all of it, but apparently, according to the leprechaun, this isn't true love.
So, you don't really love me?
I didn't say that. Of course I love you.
Then what are you saying?
I'm not saying anything, but apparently some cosmic verdict has been reached and we failed. That's all.
So you're ready to give up on us because of what a leprechaun said?
No, stop. I am just trying to figure out how to get out of here and get back to reality.
But not together.
We already tried together.
So what? Wait, you want to try with other people?
Oh, no. No, 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 no. Please, no song. I'll do anything.
Guys, we're actually in the middle of something.
You can't plow a field without hitting some stones.
Every stake's bound to have some fat. You can't eat a fish without getting some bones. Can't have love without having a lover's fat.
Would you leave us alone for just a minute?
Seriously, please.
First she says something bound to get his gander.
Then he says something mean to get her back.
Then she complains that he don't understand her.
And then he gives her a smack.
No, oh no, that's not okay. Unless it's consensual.
It's just a lover's fat.
Just cause you're feuding don't mean that you're concluding.
It's as plain.
Cecily Strong, welcome to Fresh Air. I love the show so much. It's brought me such pleasure at a time when I think we all need some pleasure. So how much do you love musicals?
Well, first of all, just thank you for saying that. I think there's nothing more thrilling than hearing Terry Gross likes your show and enjoys it and has joy from it. I'm also love the show and get a lot of joy from it. I've always loved musicals. I mean, I think it's certainly been a part of my life since I was little. You know, my grandmother would buy me musicals on VHS, and that's what I'd always rent whenever we go to the movie store. And then my uncle is also a Broadway producer, so I've gotten to see a lot of his shows in New York.
And he's not just a Broadway producer. He's like a really big Broadway producer.
Yes, thank you.
Like, among the shows he did was terrific revivals of Music Man, which is, of course, referenced in Schmigadoon, and also a terrific revival of How to Succeed in Business, a Sondheim tribute. So you must have had this idea early on that being in shows was something real people did. I mean, when I was growing up in Brooklyn, I thought people in movies and on Broadway were like from another planet. Like, they didn't connect to the world I lived in. They just performed, you know.
Yeah, I guess I knew it as a job. And I always wanted to be an actor since I was little. I think I took my first drama class when I was 3. Well, my parents put me in one, I should say. It's not like I drove myself. But I was just always performing around the house. And so I think they thought that might be a good outlet for me. And I wound up never stopping. And I think my uncle probably didn't want me to be an actor as much as I did, just knowing that it was a tough life.
Yeah, yeah. When you were going to see musicals that your uncle produced,
yeah,
did you get to meet the actors? Did you get to go backstage?
I did. And I mean, not always. I saw Guys and Dolls. I saw Once Upon a Mattress, which I absolutely loved and really wanted to do. But I certainly remember getting to go backstage after Secret Garden. And actually, my dad took a bunch of pictures. I met Daisy Egan. And my mom made a little poster for me for my room growing up that said Cecily on Broadway. And she used the playbill and a lot of those pictures. And I had that above my bed until we moved out, I think, till I went to college.
So your character in Schmigadoon is initially really charmed by the idea that they're like living in a world of a musical. And the first morning that you're there, you're having breakfast on the porch and you're being, you know, waited on by a very lovely, very young waitress. And she recommends the corn pudding. And you go like, whoa, what's that? And it's like, you don't know what corn pudding is? And so I want to play that scene because it'll give a sense of how people just kind of break out into song around you and how you sometimes just chime right in. And so we'll hear Cecily Strong doing a little solo in part of this as Keegan-Michael Key objects to her participation. So here's another scene from Schmigadoon.
I think they want us to take a verse.
I'm not singing, and you're not singing.
Come on, could be fun.
No, do not.
Never had corn pudding.
Why?
And it may be a waste, but if you've got some extra, I sure would like a taste.
Oh, she sure would like a taste.
That was so weird. It was like as soon as I started singing, I knew what to say.
That's fantastic. Can we please go now?
What? Why?
Are you serious? The entire town and you just spent the last 5 minutes singing about corn pudding.
Did somebody say corn pudding?
That's it. We're leaving.
Okay, well, that one's on you.
That was another scene from Schmigadoon, which stars my guest Cecily Strong and Keegan-Michael Key. God, this whole musical is so much fun. It's such a contrast for me, seeing the joy in Schmigadoon, because everyone in it seems to be enjoying being in it so much, and I was enjoying watching it so much. And the contrast between that and the depression and anxiety you describe in your memoir, which a lot of your memoir is about living through the pandemic, like the first almost year of the pandemic. And you shot Schmigadoon during the pandemic. What was it like for you to go from this heightened sense of anxiety and depression to flying to Vancouver? Was it Vancouver?
Yeah.
To shoot and be in these like exuberant, like joyful production scenes.
I said no, actually, at first, to going to Vancouver and shooting, because I really was afraid, you know. And then it took a while to really understand, here's all of the things we're going to put in place, here's all the safety measures, until I finally felt safe. And then it was just such a gift, you know. It really, we talk about escapism, and I had real life escapism, where I flew into this beautiful, magical land of Vancouver, where there's like water and mountains and big trees. It was gorgeous. And then to be on those sets that were also gorgeous. And then to be with this amazing group of people, and we are able to do musicals in a time when Broadway is shuttered. And that's so depressing to walk next to. You know, there were a lot of tears on set, happy tears, just so much love and so much joy and such. We were all just so honored to be there, and it felt like we got to share this magical thing. And, you know, everybody that was there was supposed to be there. It kind of felt like that a little bit. And I think a lot of that, you can feel it when you watch the show. And I think that's probably why I enjoy rewatching it so much, is just taking myself back there.
Had you been vaccinated when you shot the series?
No, because I mean, we shot in last fall, so that wasn't even, I didn't even know we'd get to be vaccinated. So we just were relying on testing.
So let's talk a little bit about your work on Saturday Night Live. I think my favorite character that you've been doing lately is Judge Jeanine Pirro, the Fox News host. You just really got her down. Was it your idea to do her, or did someone say, oh, you should do her?
No, I think it was probably Brian Tucker, who I write with, and I wound up writing a lot of my update characters with him, or sort of those, anybody that's a real person. You know, I write Marjorie Taylor Greene with him, and we did Sidney Powell together this year, too. We were in his office, and he was like, have you seen this lady? And he was showing me clips of her, like, doing man on the street interviews. But she kept going, what? And it would, like, end in some crazy, like, exclamation. And we just thought it was so funny, and it was a fun way to play her. And we wrote a sketch, actually, that didn't make it onto the show. It went to dress and not to air. And then kind of like, well, I don't know that we'll ever get to do that again. It's hard. You have to do people that everybody knows. Otherwise, it's hard to get an impression on the show. Luckily for us, but maybe who knows, for the greater world, someone else can judge, luckily or not. But she became more popular and more of a household name. So we did her on Update. And actually, I flew out of the chair the first time because, you know, I hadn't done much physical comedy on the show at all. So I really was like, come on, everybody, I have to practice this fall. I was so like mad that no one was letting me have my rehearsal. Because at Update, you only get to rehearse on Saturday, really.
So let's hear a clip of you doing Jeanine Pirro. This was performed after Pirro made anti-Muslim remarks about Representative Ilhan Omar. So here you are on Weekend Update as Judge Jeanine Pirro.
Fox News personality Judge Jeanine Pirro returned to television tonight after being suspended 2 weeks for controversial comments about a Muslim congresswoman. Here to explain is Jeanine Pirro.
I'm Judge Jeanine Pirro, and it's up to you to decide just what my whole deal is.
That's great. So you're back on Fox.
That's right. This Mueller report completely exonerated the president and therefore everybody on the Trump train. Woo, woo! So somebody at Fox News said my name into a bathroom mirror three times, and here I am. And Colin, I just want to take this opportunity to say hi to my super fans out there. Mean, horny men laying on in-home hospital beds and white prison gangs who control the remote on Saturdays. Thank you for watching.
Yeah, you know, I don't have to shout. You know, I can hear you.
Can't do it, pal. Mama's got one volume, and it's three Chardonnays deep at a crowded party.
That's Cecily Strong as Judge Jeanine Pirro. That's just so funny. What did you do to try to capture her voice?
We definitely loved the exclamations, you know, saving those for the what? And then just being loud and over enunciating and trying to have a stern look. You know, she's always got a very gravely serious affectation.
There's times on Update when Colin Jost has been laughing like so hard because you're so funny. And is it hard for you to keep a straight face when he's having trouble keeping a straight face?
I almost enjoy it more to see when someone's laughing. Then I kind of want to like go further. And, you know, there's still an element of like you're playing with your friends. And it is... It still feels a bit like controlled chaos on Update, especially where it feels kind of fresh and we're not exactly sure what's going to happen. And so it makes me want to like poke harder. If I think that he's laughing at something, I want to hit that harder.
So I want to ask you about another character that you've done, and that's the girl you wish you hadn't started a conversation with at a party. Is that an idea that you originated?
Yes. It was my first year talking with Colin. You know, we were getting ready for one of those. I think there were two Update specials because it was an election year. And he was trying to help me find things. I was a new cast member and I was talking about something else. And then I sort of made fun of myself like, yeah, because, you know, that's an important thing for society to hear or something. And then in making fun of myself, we sort of just kept playing with that. And that led into the girl you wish you hadn't started a conversation with at a party.
And who did you think of as being the girl?
Well, it was sort of a mix of, like, I'm making fun of myself, and then I'm thinking about people I'd seen on Facebook. And then I remembered, like, hearing my straight male friends talk about interactions that they'd had, like, with some girl that seems normal, and then it's like, oh, she just said something crazy, and how do I get out of this conversation?
Let's hear you as the girl you wish you hadn't started a conversation with at a party, and this is from the February 20th, 2017 edition of Saturday Night Live. We'll first hear the voice of Michael Che on Weekend Update.
With the election only 2 weeks away, both candidates are trying to get a final message out there to their supporters. Here with her final thoughts on this election is the girl you wish you had to start a conversation with at a party.
Wow. Hello, Michael Che. Thanks for finally letting a woman on late night TV.
So I assume you're not happy with the election.
Here's a thought, Michael. Maybe try being woke for a change, okay? Because Kevin can wait, but Syrian referees can't, okay? A newsflash, Michael. 40% of children are just their legs. And that's according to doctors, Michael Che.
Yeah, okay. Can you just please tell us about the candidates?
Please do not interrupt me when I'm making a point, Michael. This election is a disgrace, okay? This is a colostomy, Michael Che. And I'm sorry, if I can play devil's advocate for just a second, I think we all know the real reason Julian Assange is in jail, and that's because she's a woman. Do you even know what women have to do when we go vote, Michael? We have to show our IUD. I'm sorry, that's outrageous. That's called a double standard.
That's really funny. Talk about the process of writing that.
That's usually just Colin and I, and we both enjoy malapropisms, I think, as much as each other. So it's a lot of that. Like, what word, what is like a word that's in the social lexicon of the moment that this girl would hear and say wrong. It just like the idea, you know, that's like you can have so much passion and feelings about these things that you don't really understand and haven't given much thought to, and using them to sort of put down other people.
I love the way mansplaining becomes like, don't manterrupt me.
Right.
That makes no sense at all.
No, she's taken all these concepts and just turned them into something confusing and wrong that she's very passionate about.
In watching Schmigadoon, I had to wonder who was able to produce such a great series that is both a tribute to and a satire of musicals of the 1940s and early 50s, like Oklahoma, Carousel, The Sound of Music, The Music Man, and of course, Brigadoon. So a few weeks after talking to Cecily Strong about starring in the series, I spoke with Cinco Paul, who wrote all the songs. He co-created and co-wrote the series with Ken Dario. They also wrote the animated films Despicable Me, The Secret Life of Pets, and the Dr. Seuss adaptations Horton Hears a Who and The Lorax. We started with the opening song from Schmigadoon. A married couple played by Cecily Strong and Keegan-Michael Key have gotten lost in the woods and emerge to find themselves in a small town called Schmigadoon. The town looks like a stage or movie set from the early 20th century. The couple is totally disoriented and dumbstruck when the townspeople break into song. See if you can recognize what inspired this song. Cinco Paul, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for creating this series.
Oh, thank you for having me.
How did you come up with the idea of a musical about people trapped in a musical set in the early 20th century?
Well, it's kind of crazy. I had the idea for this almost 25 years ago. And it was while I was watching the movie An American Werewolf in London, of all things, one of my favorite movies. And it opens with, you know, two friends hiking through the wilderness, and they're hiking over the countryside. And I suddenly thought, wow, the opening to this is very much like the opening to Brigadoon. And then I thought, what if these two modern guys, instead of stumbling on a town that has a werewolf, stumbled on a town that was in a musical? And that was the germ of the idea, but I didn't really know what to do with it. So it was one of those that I just filed away. But what really cracked it for me was, oh, instead of two friends, it should be a couple. So that it is more of a romantic comedy, and it can be more about what does love mean? What's true love really mean? I think that's why for 25 years, nothing happened with it, because it needed that addition to really crack it.
So the Cecily Strong character loves musicals. The Keegan-Michael Key character hates musicals. Why did you want him to hate musicals?
Well, I thought it was really important. I mean, first of all, it's really funny to have someone who hates musicals be stuck in a musical. But also for him to be the eyes and ears of the people, unlike me, who don't love musicals. And in many ways, that was Ken. And in many ways, it's my wife, you know.
Oh, boy, you're trapped.
I'll tell you, Ken and I, you know, played music all the time when we were writing. And whenever a musical theater song would somehow pop up in my mix, he would say, skip. He was not a fan. He's become a little more of a fan. And, you know, I wouldn't say my wife hates musicals, but she does not, you know, embrace them in the way that I do. So it was really important for the show to have that perspective.
One of the things in some musicals is the love affairs in some musicals, I think, would be considered pretty age inappropriate now. like, for example, The Sound of Music, where, like, she's a young nun who's just left the convent, and she ends up, you know, falling in love with this kind of mean-spirited older man who, of course, becomes a much better human being as soon as he falls in love with her, this kind of, like, magical transformation. And South Pacific, there's a younger woman who ends up falling in love with an older man. I think you have a shout-out to that.
Yes.
And so is that one of the things you wanted to play with? And also the idea that, like, love can totally transform a person into, you know, a kind of stern, rigid person into a much more loving, lovely person.
You know, when we were in early on conceiving of the show and the journeys that our characters would take, I really wanted Cecily's character, Melissa, to be involved in what I think are the two big tropes in these old musicals. One is the bad boy, you know, which is the Billy Bigelow character. And then one is this the older sort of father figure love interest, you know, that you see in King and I and Sound of Music and South Pacific. Like, clearly it was a thing for Rodgers and Hammerstein. And there is something weird about these old men, you know, sort of creating works of art in which there are these May-December romances. And so we played with that in two ways. Also, Keegan has, you know, this young farm girl pursuing him, played by Dove Cameron, and immediately he's concerned about the age difference, especially because the actresses, you know, who play these roles were never actually teenagers. And so we play with that trope as well.
Some musicals have really corny scenes in them. And the kind of scene that always bores me is the picnic scene, where it's like, this was a real nice clam bake. I'm really glad we came. It's like, can we skip that? Can we skip that and get to the good stuff? And, you know, even like operas have like songs like that where there's, you know, like a festival or, you know, a picnic or something. And like, those are usually boring too. And I never really understand the function that they serve. And you kind of have a song parodying that called Corn Pudding.
Yes.
And so the reason why they're singing about corn pudding is it's their first morning in town, and they're sitting on the porch and about to have breakfast. And they're asked if they want some corn pudding, and they don't even know what corn pudding is. And then the town just starts singing about how great corn pudding is. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about what you think of those moments in musicals where you have to sing about food or a picnic or a clam bake.
Yeah, I mean, corn pudding came out of, initially was thinking, you know, what is the song that is most going to annoy Keegan's character? What would be the worst possible song to subject him to, you know? And it's just, oh, a song just about food. And corn pudding suddenly came to me as just it's kind of the perfect representation of these sort of songs, like the It's a Real Nice Clam Bake. Like, who cares? Like, you know, the songs really should move the story forward in some way. And I think the worst example is Shapoopy from Music Man, which is, it brings everything to a grinding halt. And then this Marcellus character is just singing this nonsense song that has nothing to do with anything. And so that's what Corn Pudding is. It's an ode to those songs. But the fun thing is that, ironically, in our show, it does move the story forward, because this stupid song gets Keegan to say, okay, we're leaving. We're not going to spend another minute in this town.
And the waitress delivering the corn pudding is the younger woman who's pursuing him.
Yes.
Why don't we hear Corn Pudding? And we'll also hear the Cecily Strong character kind of join in a verse, much to the Keegan Michael Key character's annoyance.
Corn pudding.
We want corn pudding.
think they want us to take a break.
I'm not singing, and you're not singing.
Come on, could be fun.
No, do not.
Never had corn pudding.
Why?
And it may be a waste, but if you've got some extra.
Extra?
I sure would like a taste.
Oh, she sure would like a taste.
The music is kind of like a hoedown.
Yes.
It just reminded me, too, that when I was in school, we had to learn some of that kind of dancing, you know, like square dancing.
Yeah, that was part of the curriculum
somehow.
Yeah,
I was like, why are we learning this? We live in Brooklyn. Like, what are you thinking?
I guess it was more appropriate for me growing up in Phoenix. I wonder if is square dancing still taught? In some schools, I feel like when my kids were little, they were still teaching square dancing. There must be a lobby somewhere that is making sure that that's still taught in schools.
I like that idea, the square dancing lobby.
Yeah.
I want to get to another song. We all know that so many performers on Broadway historically have been gay, and it's only in recent years that they've been able to be out. And it's only recently that there are actually musicals about gay people who are out of the closet. So you have a few really funny references to, like, closeted gay people in musicals. One of the really funny songs, the mayor, who's played by Alan Cumming, is secretly gay, and it's a secret he's never disclosed to anybody. And he sings a song that kind of is a secret love kind of song, but...
Yes, where he inadvertently reveals to Cecily's character that he's gay.
Because she has gaydar and no one in the town does.
Yes, exactly.
But the mayor's wife sings a song that's called "He's a Queer One, That Man of Mine." She has no clue that he's gay, but she knows that, you know, he's different from the other men. And usually in those songs, that's like, he's wonderful. He's so different from other men. But in this one, it's kind of like, he's so different than other men. I want you to talk about writing this, because this is an example of a song that I don't think closely adheres to another song. It's a kind of, there's references to other songs in it, including "You're a Queer One, Julie Jordan," from Carousel, right?
That's from Carousel, yeah.
Yeah. So, but talk about writing this and what you wanted to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, to me, there is a trope in these musicals often. There's a song called "Something Wonderful" from King and I, and another song from Carousel called "What's the Use of Wandering?" And I guess there's also "Can't Help Loving That Man of Mine." You know, these women who sing songs where, you know, he has maybe these flaws, but I still love him. You know, and so I wanted to play with that. But this is a song where she has no clue that her husband is gay. And so but everything that is evidence that he's gay, she sees as a really positive quality. Like, he doesn't look at other women. You know, he's amazing and he's so tender and he loves cooking. And, you know, she talks about, like, other men are really harsh but he's gentle, you know, like a lacy Valentine. And for her, it's all these really positive qualities, but also really in many ways, the mayor's story is at the heart of the show, because he is one of these characters that back in the day could only be queer coded, you know, but because we have modern characters in Schmigadoon now, and Cecily's character really likes to get involved in people's lives, she helps push him to, you know, proclaim to the whole town who he really is. And Alan does such an amazing job with this character and really gives him depth and heart in a way that elevates it even beyond, you know, what I'd hoped he'd bring.
Yeah, he's great in it. So this clip will start with Cecily Strong speaking. And I should say that the mayor's last name is Menlove. Another little clue. Okay, so here's, he's a queer one, and this is Anne Harada singing.
Mrs. Menlove, forgive me for asking, but how much do you really know about your husband?
That's a good question. He's a hard man to know, it seems. Different. Some men like to fight and curse. They smoke and drink and yell. Leave you flat, or even worse, they stay and make life hell. But my man is gentle, as soft and sentimental as any lace adorned a valentine. He's a queer one, that man, oh mine.
Oh, honey.
Some men stumble home at dark, want dinner and dessert. Other men have eyes that spark at every passing skirt. But my man loves cooking. I've never caught him looking at other gals more young, petite, or fine. He's a queer one, that man, oh mine.
This was literally me in high school.
Show me any other man more tender or expressive. I only wish that nightly he were slightly more aggressive.
There it is.
Sometimes it may seem like he is too good to be true. Like there's a man that I can't see, just aching to break through. I wish I could free him so I could finally see him the way he truly is and let him shine. He's a queer one, that man, oh mine.
That's music from Schmigadoon, the loving satire of 40s and early 1950s musicals, and my guest, Cinco Paul, co-created the series, co-wrote it, and wrote all the songs. Oh, that's really, it's a funny song, but it's also, it's a lovely song. It's a nice melody.
Yeah, I mean, that was the intention. I never wanted the songs to be too jokey, if that makes sense. You know, I really wanted them, like, oh, that could genuinely have been a song sung in an undiscovered Rodgers and Hammerstein musical. And then it ends in a very, you know, Anne does an amazing job with a song, and it ends in a really sweet spot, right? Where she sort of wishes he could be who he really is. She suspects that he's not being his true self. She doesn't know what that actually means, but she really wishes the best for him and loves him.
How were you first exposed to musicals? Like, where did you grow up? Did you see music theater? Was this all through movies?
I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, so I didn't see a lot of shows live, but my mom really loved musicals, and she had cast recordings for, I specifically remember Camelot, you know, loving as a pretty young kid and listening to it. I was a weird kid, you know, singing, "I Wonder What the King is Doing Tonight" in my room, memorizing the lyrics. But I remember, you know, Camelot and South Pacific and Guys and Dolls hearing those a lot. And so that's where my love affair with musicals began. But also I remember seeing Singing in the Rain for the first time as a kid, and Donald O'Connor doing Make Him Laugh. And I thought that was the greatest thing I'd ever seen in my life. It was so funny, and I just loved it. So that's really where it began when I was a kid. And then I think a real key moment was, I think I was 14 and was asked to play piano for my high school's musical. And it was How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. And that really changed everything, because then suddenly that became my tribe, you know, the theater kids, and they embraced me. And, you know, I desperately wanted to be on stage, but probably because I didn't really belong there, they kept saying, no, but Cinco, we need you on the piano. Please continue playing piano for us. But that's really where it deepened into something different. It became my community, you know?
What are some of the movies and some of the cartoons that you grew up with?
The first cartoon I saw that really impacted me, I think, was The Jungle Book. I loved that movie so much, and the songs in that are so good. And then I have to say the Marx Brothers have played a huge role in my life. I'm sure that's why I ended up writing movies. I saw my first Marx Brothers movie when I was 10 on TV, and I fell in love with the Marx Brothers and became obsessed. And that really led to my love of movies and reading about movies, and then starting to make my own with our family's Super 8 camera, which we'd gotten for home movies, you know, on vacation. And suddenly I used it just to make movies with all the neighborhood kids.
You love movies, and you and your writing partner, Ken Dario, have a podcast. Is this still going on, your podcast?
Yeah, it's called Make Him Watch It, and we make each other watch a movie we've never seen before.
And then you have a couple episodes where you share your opinions of films of the 80s and films of the 90s. But I want to play the theme song from this because I think it's you and Ken actually singing the song.
It is. I wrote the song.
Oh, you wrote the song. And so in the spirit of turning your life into a musical, I just want to play the opening theme from your podcast, Make Him Watch It.
Make him watch it, make him watch it. There's lots of movies Ken hasn't seen, some Cinco hasn't seen too. So now that there's COVID-19, here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna make him watch it for a podcast. We can't wait to make him watch it with Cinco and Ken.
I really love that. It's so like vaudeville era. Did you?
Yes.
How were you introduced to music of that period?
I mean, it probably came from my love of the Marx Brothers, you know, and you know, there a lot of their movies were kind of musicals, you know, The Coconuts, Animal Crackers, Horse Feathers has a lot of songs in it. So I think that led to my love of these 1920s songs, you know, the Tin Pan Alley stuff. And from the time, I was a weird little kid, Terry, I have to say, like to be a 10 or 11 year old kid obsessed with that sort of music was very odd. But I loved it from an early age.
Well, listen, congratulations on Schmigadoon. Please do a season 2. And it's been great to talk with you.
From your mouth to God's ears. Terry, I have to say, it is so meaningful to me that you like the show and that you responded to it like this. Thank you so much.
Cinco Paul wrote all the songs for the satirical musical series Schmigadoon, which he also co-created and co-wrote. It's streaming on Apple TV+. Our interview was recorded in August.